Welcome to the Admin Admin Podcast, the podcast for people working in the real world of IT. If you're a sysadmin working on the help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, a computer tech who wants to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy. It's just us two again this week. As you know from the previous episode, Jerry has been moving house. So we suspect he's still in the process of getting set up and moving stuff, and probably know what it's like to move house. So could be quite a task and quite strenuous. But we are here for episode 27. So how's it been going, and what you've been up to?
Yeah, I'm not too bad. Just busy as always. Doing quite a lot of Exchange 2013 stuff at the moment. So Yeah, probably that's why. Probably got a bit more about Exchange migrations tonight. Have you done anything with Windows 10 yet? Have you updated anything to Windows 10, Andy?
Yeah, I haven't done anybody's system, or I haven't done my own. I've been messing about with it on a VM over the past 2 days. I don't know if it's just on the VM, but I've been having trouble installing it and running it. Using VirtualBox. I don't quite know why, but once it gets up and running, it doesn't seem too bad. So just been, you know, playing with it and getting used to it and uninstalling it. And that's a good thing, because it's gone wrong a few times. I've been figuring out why it's been going wrong. But basically, I've noticed that a lot of it is all Windows 8, mostly. Just before I was booting up a VM, and then it just went straight into automatic repair mode, and then took you to the screen. You know, the Windows 8 screen, were a bit like the old safe mode, where you can do reset, repair, restore point, command prompt, all that kind of stuff. Cool. So I didn't get a chance to do it. I tried to do a check disk / what is it? R?
To repair, yeah.
Yeah. I think this is because it's a VM, then it says you don't have permission to repair this disk. So I thought, problem after problem. And also, running it in the VM, it's taking ages to install. And you're getting those really, you know, really useful messages up from Microsoft saying, we're doing something.
Yeah, I've seen loads of the screenshots.
I saw the screenshots on the actual screen. Then it said, we're still doing something. And then it said, this is taking longer than expected. But rest assured, we'll be back.
Yeah. I haven't done that. My only 8.1 machine is my work machine. And I've got my Windows 8.1, that one tablet, which got a little, I'd noticed a bit, it's got a little icon at the bottom that says you can register your interest. So I did that. But it will tell you when it's ready to install. But I haven't seen anything to install, because I'm guessing you can go to Windows Update and it will download it. But it hasn't downloaded it yet.
Yeah, there's a... I wasn't interested in doing an update. I was interested in getting the ISO file.
Yeah.
And if you go to... you have to go through a Windows migration tool.
Right.
Which you can download... and it only runs on Windows 7 and Windows 8, I think. And then through the Windows migration tool, you get the option to... This is if you don't wait, if you don't want to wait for the input update to come through, you can do it manually, you know, by going and getting this tool. And then the tool gives you the option of whether you want to install now, check your system, you know, beforehand. And then the other one is to get
ISO.
They call it something else though. They call it a create a USB install device or something. They call it. But it basically, as you follow the thing along, it brings up a save box, and then there's just a file .iso, which you then download to any location you want on your hard disk. And then you've got an ISO file, so you can either put that on a DVD or onto a pen drive and use that. And I just use that ISO file to install the VM. So, but I've actually been wondering what to do actually in the in my systems I've got here, which computer to put Windows 10 onto. I don't know whether to have it as my main PC, the one I'm running on now, or whether to run it on one of the laptops, something just to play about with, or use it, you know, either use it to play about with and to learn a bit more about, or, you know, have one to actually use as my main system or not. Not sure what to do yet. But.
Yeah, because like, obviously I can't use an ISO with my, I don't know if you can boot this tablet off an ISO or whatever, so that's because I have to wait until it downloads it. But they were saying that people was reading online saying that they bricked their laptop, that was with the, or their tablet, sorry, that's with like the preview, not the actual full one. We'll see what happens. But I made a full image of it using the USB stick.
That's a good idea to do a full image or a Cronus backup or something like that.
Well, you can do a window image inside by going to the control panel, and you basically just built an inside image. I put it onto, like, it's got an SD card in it, like the 32 gig SD card I put it onto.
Yeah.
So we'll see how it's done. So how are you anyway? We haven't said, are you going okay?
Yeah, not bad. Otherwise, we've had a bit more going on the networking stores that we've been talking about over the last couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And we've posted the schematic diagrams online.
Yeah.
Well, if you're, everyone's aware, I've done two of them with the same company in two different locations. And the second one I did has now come across some problems. Now, as of this minute, we don't have a definitive answer to this. Maybe you might have one by the time I've told you. But so you know how the setup we had before. There was a Draytec router, gigabit switch, gigabit NAS drive, everything worked great. Well, they and they're also the ones who we talked about last week who had the exchange issue on that one machine.
Yeah.
Right. So what's happened this week, the guy who runs that company phoned me up and he said, first of all, we've had fibre optic broadband install. I said, oh, right, okay. And the problem that they had is he had the fibre, but he was downloading. So he got the fibre installed and he thought, I'm going to do a speed test here to see how fast this is. And when he did a speed test, it was 10 meg download speed, which wasn't very quick compared to what he was promised, you see. So he got in touch with the people who had installed it. And they said, well, as far as we can see, we're delivering you 70 meg to your box there, to your router. You're getting a 70 meg download.
Yeah.
He said, well, I'm only getting a 10 meg.
Mm-hmm.
So he took it upon himself to unplug everything that I had plugged in to try and see if he could change anything. Yeah. Anyway, he plugged his PC directly into the new router.
Yeah.
It's not the Draytec anymore.
Yeah.
And he did a speed test, and it was 70 meg.
Yeah.
So he was made up. So he thought that was it. So he left it at that until he came to drag and drop some files from his machine into the shared NAS drive.
Yeah.
And it just took forever.
Mm-hmm.
So he tried plugging it all back in another way around. Then he had slow broadband. He plugged it back in the way it was, and he could drag and drop really quickly. But then he had 10 meg broadband again.
Yeah.
So I went over this last Monday, and I started doing the same thing. What was happening, where, and exactly what and how it was happening.
Yeah.
So basically, when you have any PC plugged directly into the router, which is a Zeisel router,
yeah,
you get 70 meg.
Yeah.
but the speed through to the NAS drive is just dead slow. It's not even 100 meg speed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not even that quick. You know, it could take 5 minutes to drag a Word document into it.
Yeah.
You know, it was that bloody slow. So I thought, okay, so let's plug it in the other way. I tried every combination that I could think of. But basically, it was really odd as well, because when the when you plug in the computer via the switch, then the switch is then uplinked from the router. You only got 10 meg. When you did a speed test, you got 10 meg. And it wasn't just some random number either. If you're at speedtest.net, it was something like 9.98, 9.99.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So it's like it's almost like it's capped at 10 meg. You know, it's a very specific thing there. So anyway, I said, well, so there's nothing we can do right now. Plus, he was also saying, well, we'll get on to the people that put the who supplied them with the router.
Yeah.
Another thing as well about the router, I haven't got the model number on me, but I can find it out. When you look up that model router on the Zeisel website and you get the PDF manual for it, the manual was written in 2006. Sorry.
Right.
And all the instructions for it were for Windows XP and Windows 2000.
Yeah.
So I think originally this router was made then, and it's possibly been modified and because this new router takes a fibre connection straight into it.
Hey, so have you got? Is this when you did the when you put that router in? Did it take the Virgo out completely then? When you have the router installed then, or not? Does the Virgo go? Sorry, does Zeisel go into the Virgo router at all, or not?
No, it completely replaced it.
Right. Okay.
So that's Virgo Draytech is gone. I don't actually know where it is. I think it's just in his cupboard somewhere. But
okay.
But of course that won't accept fiber. It's fiber via a BT line. You know, that won't accept a connection to a fiber internet connection. You say so.
All right, because it sounds like what's happening is for some reason. What gigabit switch they got there now then? Is it one you provided or something? Or
Yeah, it's nothing special. It's an unmanaged TP-Link gigabit switch.
Because it sounds like that the router, when you plug the switch into the router, into the switch, sorry, it's going at, it's configured to go at 100 meg. Sorry, 10 meg, and that's why you're getting, you're only seeing 10 meg.
Yep, that's it. I mean, I'm putting it all down to the router, definitely. Because there's nothing. I mean, as it was set up before, no, it worked perfectly fine. Plus, another difference as well is I'm pretty sure that the Draytech had a gigabit up. One of the ports was a gigabit uplink port.
Because what you could do is you could still use that Virgo and switch it around so that it works. It still works. Because does that do all the DHCP and stuff then now, then that size?
Yeah, well, that's another issue, yeah, because all the DHCP is now in the new Zeisel router.
Yeah. Because what I would do is basically get them to change it to like a PoE so that you do a PPoE, so that basically you put the Virgo back in, and then depending on that Virgo, some of the Virgos has a, you can actually put the fiber connection directly into.
Oh, right. Okay.
So depending on what model it is, and quite more than one ones, you can put it straight into it. You need to probably find out what model it is. And what you can also probably do, if not the case, you could get them to kind of change it around so that you configure one of the ports on the Virgo, so that's like an external interface, and so that it NATs it, double NATs it, so you've got the Zeisel coming in from the back of the port of the cable, that then goes into the Virgo, and then obviously then firewalls it off to the rest of the internet like you did before. So having the ADSL BT connection, you have it configured as the one of the other ports. But I would definitely, when it's connected to the if you can get admin interface into that Zizel, you want to see what speed it's connecting to. I reckon it says it's probably connecting at 10 meg is what it's got a problem with. So, yeah. So that's why you need to find a new cable or something and work out why it's connecting at 10 meg and not at 100 meg or whatever to do it. But my recommendation is that have that FireGore, see if you can get, have a look at that FireGore, and then either if it can support fiber, you can plug the router directly into the fiber.
Yeah.
If it can't, you can configure the FireGore so that it's acting as another firewall instead of having the BT connection as the outgoing port. You can configure it as another port so that you can configure, so you can plug the router directly into it. There's Zizel. Then you can obviously, then the FireGore will be doing a DHCP address again, everything will be working. You've got the full control over that FireGore again.
The thing is, to do with the DHCP and all the traffic's going through the router, because this new Zizel router is really only a home router, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And one idea I had is, I wonder if the NAS drive has a DHCP on it.
Mm-hmm.
That was something else I was thinking of, but we looked up a router to buy. And we found a router that was made by Billion,
mm-hmm.
and that took fiber in and has a gigabit uplink port.
Yeah.
One of the ports is there. So, I mean, that's another option, but we haven't bought that yet, but that's another option if we can't get any of these other ones to work mm-hmm. properly. Also, the people at the the ones that do that he's got the fibre through, they actually use PlusNet to for the actual provider, but they also do the phones, you see. This is another aspect we've got to consider,
mm-hmm.
is the they manage the IP phones at this place.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So they're managing their IP phones and they're providing them with broadband.
Yeah.
So I
would definitely check that link. If you can get onto the router and see what the internet, the connection is connecting to. Even if not, you could maybe be seeing what the lights are on the switch, on the TP-Link switch, to see if it is connecting it. Obviously, it's not managed, but you could obviously see what lights.
Yeah, because you've got the green and orange lights, haven't you?
Yeah, normally it's like an orange light if it's linking at 10 meg or something. So.
Yeah. Well, I spoke to the people at the people who provided the router, today, and they were going to they've got remote access onto the router, you see. They were going to look at it today remotely from their place to see if I spoke to them, told them what was happening, so they understood the problem. And they also said 9 times out of 10 or even more than that, this wouldn't be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's only because really of our setup with the switch and that.
How many ports that TP-Link switch got on it? How many ports do you
have? 8.
Okay.
So the router's got 4, and this has got the 8. So, I mean, one of them's took up, isn't it, by the cable linking them together. Yeah. And there's also on the system IP phones to consider as well.
Yeah.
But really, how we had it before, that didn't matter where they plugged into at all.
Okay, well, keep us updated on that one. So what else have you been dealing with? Anything interesting? Yeah. Or
Nothing really that major this week. I've been trying to work with basically a cable installer. Well, he's an electrician, really. He's actually one of my customers. I've known him for a while and done a bit of work for him in the past. And this other guy is the owner of another company. Got a fairly big house. And he's got the old problem of Wi-Fi throughout the house. You know what these big houses are like? They've got big, thick walls. And they basically, of an evening, they all basically hang out and sit around in the lounge area, which is at the back of the house, which is basically a big conservatory, which is actually added on to the house. So it's effectively outside. And it had major trouble with wireless stuff and wireless boosters and this kind of stuff, you know. So it's come to the end of its tether with it now. Even with the power line adapters, it had trouble with power line as well because they don't connect up very well. I think it's because of the length of the power cables in the walls and that. So what we're actually doing now is we're going to put a Ethernet cable or a Cat 6 cable around the outside of the house.
Yeah.
Directly into the back, where his media center and his TV is and all that lot. So then we can put in a wireless access point on the end of that cable, right where they're sitting every evening.
Yeah.
So and also he wants to do things like plug his TV and his Skybox directly into an Ethernet socket, because he can't get the smart TV to work on the wireless and all this kind of stuff. So most of the time I'm not too bad with putting cables in, but this particular house, I thought, this place has got big walls. It must be double layered brick. Then you've got drills. You've got cables. Not a problem, but. I thought, you know what, I don't really want to do this myself, you know, on this big expensive house. So I thought, well, I'm going to look up one of my customers who's an electrician. So I gave him a bell and I said, look, can you come and do this for us, or one of your lads come and do this? So so he said, yeah, no problem. So we came round on Monday just to sort it all out. So I probably have to put a... So once we've got that long Ethernet cable in, then I'll probably put a switch and a... Because we'll only pull the one cable in, switch and wireless access point at the other end of it. And then hopefully that covers all his needs.
Mm-hmm.
So so that's coming up. But otherwise, nothing too major. But I suppose the only other thing I really wanted to say about is there's been a lot of talk recently on different podcasts about installing Windows, you know, from, you know, like a new computer, a fresh reinstall of Windows.
Yeah.
And it seems to be the common trend that everybody is installing it off a Windows CD or a ISO burnt to a flash drive, and then having to go through all the waiting and downloading of all the updates and everything.
Yeah.
And for a long time now, I've made my own Windows disks and included all the updates onto them and slipstreamed mm-hmm. them all on. And I'll probably do the same with Windows 10 once there's not many updates for that yet, but that's what I do. So I have an ISO file. I don't update it too often, to be honest. I don't do it all the time, but the most recent one that I've done is probably about 20 updates old, I would say.
Yeah.
So by the time you've installed it from, I just use a pen drive, put it in, I have an unattended file on it, auto-unattend, I think it's called, which puts a lot of the answers in. So you can basically start the install and walk away. And when you come back to it, the whole system's installed.
Mm-hmm.
You can add drivers onto that ISO as well if you want to extend the driver range of what it can detect. And then once we get to that point, then at most at the minute, I'm about, you know, if it needs to do an update, it's about 10 updates to install. And it's update up to date and that. So, it seems like on the podcast that we all listen to, that lots of people are doing it the other way, you know, where you have to wait for it to download every single time or use a WSUS.
So how do you slipstream?
Yeah, well, I basically use a program called WinToolkit. If you search that, you can find a link for it. And what allows you to do, I mean, okay, granted, this is a long process to do this. You use this tool, you copy an ISO file or copy an actual Windows disk into a folder in the program, so it has that as the reference. Within the tool, you can also go and download Windows updates. And that means you have to download all of the updates all at once. But you've got to bear in mind that's the only time you have to download them. Once you've downloaded the updates, you can then use the word, I think they use the word import into the original image. So then it starts doing the slipstreaming, which is putting those updates onto the original image. That is the bit that takes a long time. I mean, that can literally take... I do it on an SSD drive to try and speed things up, and that can take about 8-10 hours to do.
Okay.
Something like that. You can also do other things with the toolkit as well. You can predefine product keys if you needed to, or you could predefine the user profile name. You can predefine the computer name or the group or domain that it will be getting connected to or whatever. You can do all this, and then once it's created it and slipstreamed it, which is a long process, then you can, what you've got left then is the setup you want, and then it the Win Toolkit then can make an ISO file out of the what you've just made.
Okay.
And that new ISO file, this is a big difference, that new ISO file can be 8 gig or something.
Okay.
So at that point, it doesn't fit on a CD anymore. It doesn't fit on a DVD, I should say. Way too big for that. So it's only really useful for a pen drive.
Okay.
Which are faster anyway, the way I see it. But I mean, that's how I do it. I tend to do that slipstreaming thing probably every, 6 months or 9 months or something like that. Because otherwise you just end up with an ISO file which is, you know, a year out of date still, and it kind of defeats the object.
Well, it's a bit of a good tool anyway, so...
Yeah, it's quite good, yeah. But one thing I was going to say is, in yours as a corporate world where you've got, just to give a figure, you know, 100 to 1,000 workstations on one system or one domain, do you have something similar if you had to, you know, deploy a workstation which was needed reloading, or, you know, you had a new base unit that you needed to give out to somebody? Do you have a predefined image, if you like?
Yeah. So as I've spoken through the tool, we use a MDT toolkit, which is like a Windows product where you can basically... You capture the image. So you basically build the image you want, and then you just Windows update it however high you want to go, customize it, install all the apps you want it, then you sys prep it, and then you then take an image of that, and then that then gets put up to your MDT server, and then obviously you can then push it out to your machines, kind of thing. So then every couple of months we would kind of do the same thing. We would deploy an image,
yeah,
and then import it again. The same thing with the servers. Like with our, if you've got 1,000 servers to manage, you don't want to, and like you're getting people to ask with virtualization. You have templates with VMware. You want to basically you get someone from say, we need this VM for this accounting package. Yeah, where's your request? Where have you? we need it tomorrow, yesterday, because we've got the guy on today installing the software. So you can basically just deploy a template. So right click, deploy VM from template, and then you've basically got your VM. So what you normally do is you create your VM how you want it, and then you just convert it to a template, and then in Windows, you in then VMware, you can just deploy the host from it. So then obviously what we do every couple of months is just deploy one again from a template, and then update it, and then convert it back into a template, so that then we've got an updated template. So when you only have to deploy it, it's already got all the updates.
Oh, that's brilliant. So that, I mean, that's very similar to what we're talking about, but they are for, are all of those workstations the same? As in, they're all HP or they're all...
Yeah, normally, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, sometimes, not too much now, in the olden days, we'd have problems with different drivers like the ID and the SATA. So yeah, we'd have a number of images. When I worked for another corporate company, we had about 700 PCs and laptops. And yeah, we just have different images for different models. But that's why in the corporate world, I always try and say, look, it's easier just to buy the same models or have four or five different models. And that's any models you have. You don't like, oh, we'll just buy the cheapest one we can get kind of thing. You keep to a standard kind of thing.
So that image is great for all of your systems, but
yeah,
this Win Toolkit. I mean, I have to be good for any system, you know, whether it's a Dell or an Asus or a whatever.
How does it do with like activation, like when it comes to activating? Because obviously we're normally like the OEM ones, automatically updates, automatically activate, doesn't it?
Yeah,
but I'm guessing if you just put the CD code in from the bottom of the laptop.
When the install is finished, you come back to the machine and you've got the desktop on there, you think, okay, that's done. Then there are a few little things that you need to do to kind of tidy it up, if you like. You could, if you wanted to, go in and change the PC name, computer name. Or you could change to the work group that it was on if you needed to. There's still other things to do, such as, you know, install the particular software that they may want in there. Not everyone wants Skype or Chrome or Firefox or whatever. So I tend to make my images without all those programs on it. And then once you get to the desktop, the things you need to tidy up are things like you need to right-click onto properties and it tells you Windows is not activated. So you can then go into that, look on the bottom of the laptop or side of the case, type in the product key, and then it activates. So that's one thing you need to do. And then if they've got things like Office or they want particular other software installed, you know, then you install that then. But, I mean, you'd do that anyway, wouldn't you, even if you had to wait for all the updates to come in?
Yeah.
You'd still have
to
do that.
So it is quite good, this tool. I mean, it looks like it. You can do Office and stuff as well. I'm just reckoning what this is doing is that what you can do is you can do offline updating, which like what we can do like with our corporate images using DMT is that you can basically, if you've got an image, you can use a command line and you can say, look, I want these updates installed or I want these features installed. I wonder if this is just a pretty front end for it. So it's really good. Well, how did you find out about that How did you find out about that in the first place?
Oh, God. That's a good question. I'm trying to remember now because I used to, going back to Windows XP, I tried it in Windows XP and it failed miserably. And I could never get it to work with this other software. So it came a point, this is when Windows 7 was still going strong, and the reason I thought about it is because I'd tried it before, and I thought, I wonder if there's another way of doing it now. I remember how I got to that particular program. It was one of Brytech on his YouTube channel.
Okay.
I was looking it up And I think I just kind of stumbled across it, but knew what it was as soon as I seen it. And then I saw one of his videos was on about slipstreaming or something like that, it was calling it. And I thought, ah, yeah, I want to try that, because I'd been getting frustrated with having to install updates every single time. And to be honest, though, at the time, I was doing that an awful lot more than I am now. I don't do reinstalls as much as I used to. I think it's more that you can... That's it, more nowadays that you can fix problems, get rid of infections, fix Windows repairs and stuff like that. You've got the tools to do it an awful lot better nowadays, I think. So you can fix things without having the need to nuke and pave it. But I still have it ready. And another thing that's slow about the process as well when you're making them is you have to do a completely different image for each version of Windows that you want to have. So on Windows 7, you've got to wait 8 hours for the home version to finish. You've got to wait 8 hours for the pro version to finish. That's all I've done in the past is those two. And if you wanted the basic or the ultimate, you'd have to do them as well. But it's definitely worthwhile. And also as well, who it's useful for are system builders.
Yeah.
If someone builds and then wants to send a system out with Windows on. It's just a speed thing, really. It's one of those things you can start installing and then walk away from. Mm-hmm. You don't have to click next, accept this. You don't have to type in the product key as it's installing if you don't need to. You don't have to select the time zone that you're in. You know, all these things that it asks.
Yeah.
Which did make me wonder as well as is there a similar thing for doing the likes of Windows Server?
Yeah, or is you use an antenna.xml and stuff. You can all that kind of thing. So
yeah, because you say I'd have thought that setting up a server would be sort of so specific to a generalized setup wouldn't work.
But if you think you've got to run, run 100 servers or whatever, and they all need to be the same, you want to have someone can easily make the mistake. So
yeah, that's true. Yeah.
I think we've got Jerry on the line. That sounds like we're on the. Can you hear us, Jerry?
Can you hear me? Yeah.
Can
you hear me?
We can.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Oh, excellent, excellent. Usually, I sometimes get blank looks when when I start speaking, because there's always a technical fault at my end, but good to see you guys. Sorry I couldn't make the start of the podcast, but got there in the end.
So are you in your new house then?
I am, yeah. It's all kind of getting there. I've been putting blinds and curtains up tonight, which is why I couldn't join you till a bit later. Mm-hmm. It's essential that the blinds went up tonight. So
no one could see you doing the podcast?
That's right, yeah.
It's a secret. It's a national secret, you see.
Yeah,
I've got the curtains drawn.
It's not too echoey. I'm actually in the one room that hasn't got curtains.
So have you got a nice fibre connection now then, Jerry? Or
it's VDSL. This is what I wasn't aware of. It's I don't know. It's very high rate digital subscriber, mm-hmm. which seems to me like it's not fibre, even though it says it's fibre. In the blurb.
No, that's what VDSL is. That's what the fibre is running on. That's what it is.
Oh, okay. Is it still copper?
Yeah, it's still copper.
Yeah, it's still copper to the house, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So it's fibre to the cabinet.
It's fibre to the cabinet down the road somewhere.
Yeah. So the D slam is in the D slam is in your is in the cabinet instead of being at the exchange.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So the last mile is, in fact, the last 100 foot or so.
Yeah.
Do any of your places, Al, have fibre cable to the building?
I haven't had fibre to the premise yet. No, we have a number of customers who like have fibre. Like if you've got like you want a 100 meg line up and down, then yes, we've got it like that way. But I haven't got anyone who's got like FTTP yet. So that's right. Fibre, as in like you've got a leased line into your building, so you have basically have a fibre connection from your office to the exchange, and then back toward onto the internet. So
sounds expensive.
Yes, it is.
But you would do things like fibre connection between two buildings within an organisation, for example.
Yes.
I remember the college you used to go to had one of them. You know, the fibre cable hanging between two buildings. Yeah. So, so we were talking about fibre before, weren't we? So, yeah. I actually don't know when you've been kind of hanging out there, spying on us for I don't know how long. So,
I've been listening for about 10 minutes, I think.
Oh, right, okay. Then.
Well, since I started typing in the chat thing. So.
Yeah. So, have you got anything to tell? Jerry?
Last night I did a talk. I gave a talk, but it was only to about five people about Ansible, which is the config management system that I've mentioned before on the show.
Yep.
Which is quite fun. I think I stumbled over my words and said a lot, but I think I got the message across to the five people that were there. So. I'm going to put the slides are on Google Slides, so if I can work out how to put them up somewhere, I would put a link to them in the show notes, and then I'll do that. Yeah,
you can download each slide as a JPEG.
Yeah, Well, there's these sites like SlideShare, SlideShare.net is one, I think.
Oh right.
I learn quite a lot by just looking at people's slides from talks they've done. So
where was that then, Jerry?
That was a Brighton system sysadmin and network engineer group. So, first time I've been there. So there's a couple of guys there that I know quite well from the sort of Brighton digital sort of freelance scene. I was just talking to them. it's good. It's good.
You talked to a few more people doing this.
Hmm. Yeah,
it's
true,
not right in front
true.
Of you.
Yeah. So that was fun. Other than that, I've just been doing lots of DIY, trying to piece my home network back together. And that's pretty much it, yeah.
So I was going to say, I was talking about Windows 10 earlier. There's a new feature in Windows 10 called Azure AD Join. So you know, I was talking last week on the Exchange about in Office 365 there's like an Azure AD, which is basically the AD backend for Office 365. Well, now what you can do, if you've got a Windows 10 laptop or tablet, you can auto enroll that laptop with Azure AD. So like, you know, in your PC in your office, you can join it to the domain, and then obviously the admins can then you can administrate it or do whatever you want to lock it down by Greek policy. Well, with Azure AD Join, you can basically, when you set your laptop or when you boot your new Windows 10 laptop up, like it's new from a shop, you've got an option to join it to Azure AD. So you'd use your Office 365 username and password, and you would join it to Azure, and you'll basically like be able to control it. So if there's a thing in Office 365 called the MDM, which is basically Mobile Device Manager, and you can from there you can configure it, so you can lock down what it is, what applications the user can install on it. This is quite interesting. About how I haven't actually had to play with it. I just really something came off my feed the other day.
So your Active Directory, basically your users and everything is in the cloud effectively, and your Is Office 365 cloud based as well? Can you run?
Yeah, Office 365 is cloud based, and then the back end of that, like it has its own internal AD, which you can basically sync with your internal AD if you want to. So you can do things like single sign on, etc., etc.
Yeah,
so it's quite interesting.
Well, the other thing, you leave it purely in the cloud as well.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, so that's but can you have say your a load of workstations on-prem, obviously on-premises, and then they're authenticated against Azure AD?
I think so. That's what their master plan is in the end, is what they want you to do with Windows 10. Because we've got customers in the end now where we've migrated into Office 365, and they're all they've got their domain control on premises is for is their local AD authentication. It doesn't host anything because all their emails and everything are in the cloud, all their file servers are in the cloud, but we still need something to basically lock down their PCs and control their PCs basically. So
I suppose if the internet connection goes down as well, you can't authenticate.
No, but yeah, but that's why you kind of have a The other thing I was going to mention about is that there's I came across something the other week is about obviously resetting or setting up local admin passwords. As I could say again, if you've got 1,000 workstations out on there, you don't want to have all those 1,000 workstations having the same admin password, because if someone cracks that admin password, because obviously it's got the same hash as you, because obviously what you can do is you can obviously take offline the SAM database on that computer and then obviously brute force it and then find out what the password is. And if you find out that one password administrator is, you can then obviously use all your administrator, you can use that administrator password on the remaining PCs, if you see what I mean. And that's why a lot of old people, me included, used to have the same local admin password as your domain admin password. So then obviously if you get that, then you've got your domain admin password. So in the past, I've known people kind of thing where like you have an equation, like it's a computer name times 10 or something, or you have some sort of calculation to work out. But Microsoft actually come out with this solution called LAPS, which is basically a way of setting the passwords on the rest of your domain PC. So you basically install this LAPS, and it basically extends the schema in AD, which is a bit scary. And you basically have to install a client on each of the PCs, which is this LAPS client, but you can roll that out by group policy. And then using group policy, you can then configure it and then randomly set a password on each of the PCs. And then to obviously find out what that Windows, once it's been set, you can either use the LAPS command tool with like a fat client. You can basically browse the computer name and it'll tell you what the password is. It even resets the password every 30 days. So if you need to go to that PC and do something on that local machine, you've got the password. Or you can use you can go to user computers and basically go to the attribute editor, and there's like an option there which basically tells you what the admin password is. So that's what I've been kind of playing with this kind of week. And then the other thing I've been doing about Exchange migrations sizing your Exchange migration. There's a number of tools out there. Basically, there's a spreadsheet from Microsoft which you can put all your information in, and it will basically tell you what size Exchange server you need to build. But you need to know a couple of things to actually put that data in that spreadsheet. And it asks you how many messages go in and out of your organization a day, how many does each user send, and what the average mail is sent. So the profiler tool you can download from the Microsoft website, and you can see it basically run it on your Exchange database, and it basically tells you what that information is.
I've often wondered how what if you've got a place which is brand new and they've got nothing there, how do you size up a server for them, because you don't have any information to go on. How do you say, well, you need this size server, you need this size hard drives, you need this capability, you need this, how would you go about that if you had a completely new business where you knew nothing about them?
You just have to guess, really.
Just guess. Yeah, overestimate a bit, try and take in Because you often find that with people, don't they, or companies, or even people at home. You know, I've had it where they've got a new computer, say, and then all of a sudden this new computer is far superior than than the 2002 XP computer with half a gig of memory that they used to have. And now all of a sudden they can do this and they can do that, and now they want to do more. They want to do more and more, and the new computer they just bought isn't good enough. You know, so you've got to take that into account, no doubt, of, you know, how can they expand in and cost as well, I suppose.
Think of a number and then double it.
Yeah.
The way to do it.
But then if the customer then says, oh, hang on, that's a bit expensive there, then at least you can come down a bit and get something a bit cheaper, but then still know it should still work for them.
I mean, if you're talking about something like Exchange, then your main concern is probably going to be storage space, isn't it? People sending attachments around and things.
Yeah.
So it depends how you handle the storage. If you've got a storage array where you can easily add disk and so on, then it wouldn't be so much of an issue, possibly.
The Exchange databases and storage, do they save everything, as in attachments going out and attachments coming in? It is a question about Exchange, I suppose. Say you sent an email with an attachment on. I'm trying to get this right here. Say you sent an email with an attachment on, or say you received an email with an attachment on, and then you forwarded it to somebody else. Would that attachment then be saved twice? In the one in the inbox and one in the sent? Or would it just be saved once?
I don't know the answer to that.
No, I've often thought. Where would it go?
I mean, by default on Linux systems, it's not. But it sounds like a feature you'd get more in. You might get it in Exchange, or there might be some lower level thing which sort of does deduplication of data like that. So if you've got the same file in two sort of logical locations, then it's only on disk once. But yeah, I'm not sure about that.
But if you were say I sent you an attachment, and then you replied back. No, like I was thinking this, you know, with the conversations you have in Gmail and that, rather than email in and email out.
I'm sure Gmail has deduplication. Gmail, yeah. I'm sure Gmail has deduplication
The attachment's still in the conversation, isn't it, as you have it?
Yeah, yeah.
But it's only there once, you know.
Yeah.
We could then reply back and forth 20 times, but we're not sending the same attachment back and forth 20 times. It's still only there once.
If you look at it in a normal mail client, though, when you reply and it's got the text, it keeps the text, you know, if you're top posting or whatever, it will often have like a text thing saying there was an attachment here, and the real attachment is attached to the original mail, which is, you know, however many mails ago. And I think with Gmail, it's more about the interface. So the mails are probably handled in a normal way, but then it's just how it's presented to the user. So yeah, I think that's the main difference there. I mean, the other thing with Gmail is you can have things in Google Drive, can't you? And just so they're not, you know, in your mailbox, if you like.
Yeah, you can send it off without.
You know, it's probably abstracted far away anyway. You know, your Gmail exists. Your Gmail account or its data exists in lots of different places around the world, and so on for redundancy.
Right. So, well, we'll carry on. Al's got some microphone problems.
Technical hitch.
Technical
That's usually
hitches.
my microphone that dies.
It's spreading. Hopefully you've got yours sorted out. I mean, you're sounding all right today, and it seems to have a good connection. So, the only thing is bad that I'm using some crappy headphones at the minute. But, but anyway, while you're on, and while we're waiting for Al to come back, several episodes on, you were talking about little NAS drives and servers, little home servers and stuff. This is just a quick question to kind of guide me in the right direction, if you like. I've got a little Buffalo, I suppose NAS drive is the word for it. I really only use it as a shared drive, shared Windows drive. Usually have it mapped just for easy access. Anyway, the problem I have is I cannot access it over the network at all. It's got the, I'll tell you what it's got. It's got the IP address, which I'd set as static, as 1.80. Now, if you go into any browser and do the 1.80 to get into its main menu, it can't find it. You know, it doesn't bring up the web interface at all. If you went into the Windows network, you know, to look in the local network, it doesn't find it at all. I've got it mapped as a drive within Windows, and obviously that doesn't find it at all either. I then used one of those IP scanners, the LAN scanner that you can get. I think it's like Angry IP. You know, it's like a local LAN IP scanner. Can't remember what the name of the one is.
So, I only heard about half of what you said, because I think every time I go to... See, I'm Googling things, and I think every time it does that, I lose a bit of connection. So I've only heard about half of what you said. So you got a NAS, your Buffalo NAS.
Yep. So I've got Buffalo NAS.
What's happening with it?
So I cannot access it over Windows Network.
Right.
I cannot, it has I just call it Buffalo, / Buffalo is the name I use for it. Can't find it on that. It's mapped as a drive letter, and obviously I can't find it on that. It has a local IP of 1.80, which I've set as static.
Can you ping that from somewhere else?
Well, that's an idea. I'm going to try that right now, because that leads on to the other thing. When I know you can use IP scanners, local LAN IP scanners. When I run that, it finds it. It says 1.80, and it does a description of the manufacturer's name or whatever, and it says Buffalo Incorporated or whatever. Okay, there we go. I'm just pinging it, and I've got replies back on all four of them.
Okay,
so it's pinging. I cannot access it on Windows networks. I cannot access it through a web interface, but the IP address is there.
Okay. Have you restarted it at all? Because it might just be that.
Yeah,
it's alive. The network's alive, but nothing else is. So you can basically ping it, but none of the other services are running.
Yeah, I mean, I've rebooted it several times.
Have you got a port scanner?
Port scanner. A program.
I guess it's on Windows. You might be able to get a. On Linux, there's something called Nmap, which you know, you can point it at hosts and say, "Is this port open? Is it, you know, or what ports are open on this host?" So,
all right.
If you had one of those, you could find out whether, like, you could. Look at port 80, and if it responded on port 80, you'd know that the web server is running.
Okay.
And I think the Windows ports are 137 and 139 and 445 or something.
Okay.
That it uses for Windows, for Samba shares. But yeah, I think you need to try and find something like that. So you can't get into the web interface. It sounds like it might have died.
Yeah, because it doesn't look like the hard drives have failed or anything. It doesn't look like...
No.
There's a couple of lights on the front which basically say power, network. The curious thing is it's power, network, and error light,
yeah.
Which is red. And there's no error light on it.
Yeah.
And the network light is flashing like crazy when you're trying
to
do anything. It's like it's halfway there, but not fully. So
yeah,
but that's an idea. I never thought of doing port scanning, but I'll listen back to this or look up those those port ones and or see if I can just get into the cause once I can get into the web interface, then I'm laughing. Then that should be sorted.
Yeah. Hello.
Hi, Al.
That's great. So Al's back. So you had some microphone problems there.
I had to completely reboot my machine. It does completely crash. And I was like, you were going about the exchange thing and about the sizing, and I was just going like, why aren't they listening to me? And I just thought,
I know that feeling.
I have that all the time anyway. So
go back to exchange question. Before exchange 2010, and like from 2007, 2010, it used to only record one single item. So once it got an attachment, it stored it in your exchange, and it just referenced it into all the other mailboxes. Since Exchange 2010, it's gone away from that again because they've redesigned the database, how it laid out. And it just like, if you've got five attachments, if someone sends like a 10 meg email that sends out to 10 people, that's 100 meg storage you've got. Usage, but because I think you need to have that storage is so cheap, it's not a problem. So there you go.
Yeah, I suppose it is really cheap now, isn't it? Was that a bigger issue?
Yes,
sort of 10 years ago, 15 years ago. Yeah. But storage is megally cheap, isn't it? So
were you talking about Nmap then, or not then? Before I got cut off, or not?
Nmap.
Oh, were you? Oh, I wasn't.
Was Jerry talking about Nmap or not?
Yeah. It's just a port scanner on Linux. So, as I was just explaining to Andy, you can point at a host and tell if the host is up or down. You can do all sorts of things. Like, it will try and work out from by pinging it or doing certain things to ports. What OS is running on it, so you can tell if you're if it's Windows or Linux, or if you're pinging a switch or something like that. So
I've heard of Nmap before, but I never really thought of using it. And then I was listening to that Sysadmin Trivia podcast this week, and they were talking about it.
Yeah.
So I sort of give it a go kind of thing. It's like there's a load of videos on YouTube. There's a Hack 5 channel. I don't know if you ever watched it. It's a really good channel. And there's like little snippets of how to do it. So I was planning on giving it a go
There's lots of different options, but you can, I mean, like Andy, you were saying about IP scanning, you can literally say nmap 192.168.1-254, and it'll just scan all those hosts on that subnet and report back to you, and that's a really easy one to remember. It's got all sorts of different options about how you can scan hosts, and like if they've got ping turned off, which it can happen. I think Windows Firewall does that, doesn't it, by default? You can do a non-ping probe, so you can tell if there's any ports open on that host and so on. So yeah, it's really useful. I use it quite a lot actually, and I'm not even in a kind of black hat hacker kind of way, but just day to day really. So
the other thing as well is, did you say it's a Buffalo NAS or something, did you say?
It's my Buffalo NAS I've got at my house. Yeah, you probably missed some of that, didn't you? Basically, the situation with it, it's got a static IP on the local network of 1.80. I cannot get onto the web interface on any browser, on any machine. I cannot find it in Windows networks. You know, if you can explore around the networks and /// Buffalo, I just call it, I think it was. Cannot find it with that. But I used a local LAN IP scanner, and I found it on the 1.80. Even knew it was a Buffalo. And Jerry just said, "Now, why don't you ping it?" So I pinged it, and it's pinged as well. So it's seeing it as an IP address, and it recognises it as a Buffalo device. But that's as far as I'm getting, you see.
Have you tried /// 192.168.180?
No.
That was my next suggestion.
Yeah.
And the other thing as well, that Buffalo, great, a lot of these NAS devices have a utility you can download off the web, and it will basically scan your network and tell you.
Yeah. I've downloaded it, and it can't find it.
The Buffalo NAS Navigator is what you want. Have you tried that?
Yeah, I think it's called that. I've got the program somewhere on here. Ooh, I'll have to find it again.
You may find it's got a Telnet or SSH interface. Fairly unlikely, but you might be able to use PuTTY or something similar to communicate it with like a console. But it's fairly unlikely, I think that.
NetScan. One I tried using was called NetScan. As the IP scanner, but that's the I'm just running that scanner again now, and it's found it again. And even as well, you know, the IP scanner gives you the MAC address. And the MAC address is the same.
Well, we'll have a look after the show. We can kind of, maybe you can screen share, and we can have a quick look for you. We have a look.
All right, yeah.
The other thing I wanted to go more about the exchange kind of thing, my migration thing, but we've gone for an hour now, so we might as well wave it to the next time. The only thing we'll narrow Jerry's hair is we were going to ask him about the hashing of passwords and the other way of doing it. So
sorry, you cut out again there. All I heard was you were going to ask me about the hash.
On the other podcast, we were just talking about the hashing of passwords and why that's more secure than encrypting passwords.
Right.
You posted something about encryptions, didn't you, or something today. Is that to do with that?
Oh, yeah, that was me. That was more about it's interesting watching about that. Obviously, the UK government's trying to block the encryption because they can't obviously decrypt the traffic to stop terrorists or whatever. But if you're going to block, they basically want to have a copy of all our private keys, whatever, so they can decrypt the traffic. But yes, all a bit odd. But no, we were just talking about the way that how you can hash passwords and you can encrypt passwords in databases, kind of thing. So,
okay. As I understand it, a hash is a way of encrypting a password, A hash is what you end up with when you encrypt a password, as I understand it.
But you can't decrypt it, can you, though? That's the thing.
No, it's one way. The way the maths works is you can only do it one way.
But
when you've got the hash, you can't reverse engineer it.
Yeah.
Well, you can. You can brute force it, but...
But the other way is that if you encrypt a password, then you obviously encrypt it with a key, and if you've got that key, you can decrypt it. Because the way I understand it is that you encrypt, so you put a password into a website, it hashes it, it puts it, stores in a database in a hash format. There's no way someone can get that password out. So if someone basically compromises that website and gets that hash, they can't decrypt it. But when you put your username and password into a website, obviously it then hashes your password again and then matches it to the hash in your exchange, in your database. And then it says, oh, yeah, those match, so it must work. So that's why I was talking.
So it's comparing the hashes of the passwords rather than passwords themselves.
Yes. And that's what I was saying about with my Office 365 last week, is when it sends a hash up into the cloud, obviously it doesn't show generally the password into the cloud, it just sends the hash. And obviously when you go to Office 365 and log in, it encrypts that hash in the same way, and it matches, and that's how it comes about. So I think we're going for quite a long time now, about an hour and a bit now, so we're back on the roll, I think, guys. We've got a couple of shows in the pipeline to get published out. So,
I'm finally back after moving house. So, hopefully, I'll be a bit more of a regular contributor now. So,
so we're going to talk about as well OddCamp again, haven't we? So, are we going to plan to meet up that for OddCamp? Do you think a bit of an Abin podcast meetup?
Yeah,
that'd be great. Yeah. I'll have so far to travel though, that's the problem.
Yeah.
I'm gonna have to go at least 5 miles.
Yeah. So, you can probably come on your bike, Andy.
I'll come on my bike. I'm not gonna ride my bike through the Mersey Tunnel. That's the
You can get the Mersey boat across, or you can take the sub or the train and kind of get takes you to the
I go on the train.
Yeah.
Well, where is it then? Do you know basically where it is?
It's going to be at Liverpool John Moores, isn't it?
Yes.
I think we looked it up, didn't we?
Liverpool John Moores is a big place. A
couple of weeks ago.
John Moores is
a
collection of lots of colleges all around the city. So, we'll have to find the specific building.
Yeah, they haven't released. Still there, guys. They haven't released much about it yet. So,
yeah, there's a couple of like college halls and things like that, which you could probably, you know, take it. I've got an idea of a few places it could be at, though. But yeah, as soon as we find out, we can definitely do that. But it's up around, when did you say it? Halloween type of 31st, end of October, is it? Something like that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's the last weekend of October, I think. It's basically the half term weekend in the UK, so basically the 30th, 31st and the 1st basically.
I won't be able to do the Halloween one day night. Mm-hmm. But the other two nights I should be fine for.
Yeah, so it's all during the day and stuff. Cool. So yeah, it will officially finishes at 4 o'clock or something on that Sunday, but I'm gonna stay over the Sunday and then get a train back on the Monday. So cool. All right, thanks for listening, guys, and thanks for coming along, Jerry, and joining us halfway through.
Yeah, made it in the end. Yeah,
that was great. So we'll see you all next week.
Yes, see you soon, guys.
See you guys. Bye.